With Relevant Radio News, I'm Mary Graham. A Kenyan national is being indicted for helping to plan a 9/11-style attack on the United States. The U.S. Attorney's Office in New York says 30-year-old Kolo Abdi Abdullah obtained his pilot's license in the Philippines at the direction of the terror group Al-Shabaab. He also allegedly conducted research on how to hijack a commercial airliner for a planned attack on a building in a major U.S. city. The FBI and other enforcement members were able to foil the plot. Abdullah remains in custody since his initial arrest in the Philippines. The annual Epiphany Celebration and Cross Dive in Tarpon Springs, Florida, will take place next month, but without the big crowds. Here's more from Reed Shepherd.
Officials with St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Cathedral say there will still be an 8 a.m. service, but the Mass will be limited to 50% capacity. There will be no formal procession to Spring Bayou, and a viewing area near the water will be set aside for a maximum of 2 family members per diver. Only those 18 and over can participate, and there will be no celebration after the cross dive. The event normally draws thousands to Tarpon Springs each year. I'm Reed Shepherd.
A major winter storm is working its way up the East Coast. NBC News meteorologist Bill Caron says there hasn't been a storm like this in 2 or 3 years.
Last winter, the Northeast Corridor had barely any snow at all. New York City was like 4 inches. Philly and D.C. didn't even have an inch all last winter. So that's why this is kind of a big deal for a lot of people in this region.
The federal government is revealing a Southeast Texas megachurch received a Paycheck Protection Program loan. Joel Osteen's Houston area church got over $4 million in July after the Small Business Administration reopened the program. Other churches in Texas, including First Baptist Church of Houston and Dallas, Potter's House in Dallas, and the Archdiocese of Galveston, Houston, got federal cash as well. Keeping you connected with the church and the world, this is Relevant Radio.
1942 marked the year that our founder, Venerable Patrick Peyton, embarked on his quest to create family unity through daily prayer of the Rosary. 78 years later, we at Holy Cross Family Ministries still work to unleash the power of family prayer with mission offices worldwide by distributing over 1 million rosaries each year and sponsorship of Relevant Radio's Family Rosary across America. A world at prayer is a world at peace. Holy Cross Family Ministries, hcfm.org.
Underwriting by Christendom College.
Are you worried that we're losing our Catholic heritage these days? You can rediscover the roots of our faith thanks to a new free online class from principals in Christendom College. Join my friend, Christendom College President, Dr. Timothy O'Donnell, for his class on Christ, the Center of History. Together, you'll explore history from a Catholic perspective to help you know, live, and share your faith. You can get free access to the Catholic History class by going to principalsclasses.com. Sign up today at principalsclasses.com.
St. Emmerich's Church on the near west side of Cleveland would leave the beautiful Christmas decorations up until February 2nd, a full 40 days after Christmas. Hi, this is Father Rocky with another Advent inspiration. The Christmas decorations inside of St. Emmerich's Catholic Church were so beautiful, so ornate, so elaborate, I figured, well, it took so long to put them up, you might as well leave them up a long time. But then I discovered that some people, especially from Eastern European countries, stretch out the Christmas season all the way to February 2nd. That's the Feast of the Presentation of the Christ Child in the Temple, and also known as Candlemas, because your holy candles can be blessed that day. For Catholics, the official Christmas season starts at sundown on Christmas Eve and lasts until the Feast of the Baptism of the Lord, which is on the Sunday after Epiphany. Epiphany is when the three kings came to adore the Christ Child, and that is the 12 from 12 Days of Christmas.
Visit us on our mobile app or at relevantradio.com/advent.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Wonderful Wednesday to you. So glad to have you on board with me for the Cale Clark Show. Give me a call, 1-888-914-9149. That's our toll-free studio line, 1-888-914-9149. You can also hit me up on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We also have our famous show account. Well, it's getting more famous, at least, at Cale Clark Show. You can check that out, too. Follow that account. And you can email us, cale@relevantradio.com. You know, somebody quite famous is celebrating quite a milestone birthday today. And in fact, producer Lucas Holt and I have been slaving away, working all day long on this musical tribute for this person. And here we go. All right, Lucas, hit it in 3, 2, 1. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. Happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. Beethoven! Happy birthday! Yes, that's right. It is Beethoven's 250th birthday today. Can you believe that? Ludwig von Beethoven was born on this day, December the 16th, 1770. Wow. And he was actually baptized into the Catholic faith the very next day. And people didn't wait too long back then to get their kids baptized. That is for sure. And obviously, what an incredible impact he has made on the world. And Lucas is, as you might know, Lucas is a lot more cultured than I am. And in fact, he has been, but I wouldn't want to say getting on the nerves of people around the Relevant Radio studios today, but he has been carrying around a boombox on his shoulder, blasting Beethoven all day long and wearing a party hat, streamers. Yeah, it's getting a little bit embarrassing, but yeah, I can't blame him. I mean, he grew up, you know, as a kid with a picture, with a painting, with a poster of Ludwig von Beethoven on his wall. I did not. You know whose poster was on my wall? Jim McMahon. The punky QB, the quarterback of the 1985 Chicago Bears.
I'm the punky QB known as McMahon. When I hit the turf, I've got no plan. I just throw my body all over the field. I can't dance, but I can throw the field. I motivate the cats, I like to tease. I play so cool, I aim to please. That's why you all got here on the double, to catch me doing the Super Bowl shuffle.
Yeah, that's not exactly a Beethoven-esque. But that was, of course, the Super Bowl shuffle. Of course, you may remember that one. The greatest team in NFL history, the 1985 Chicago Bears. And I have to laugh because every time the Bears play the Packers, I refer to that very lovingly as the Relevant Radio Bowl, because about half the staff of Relevant Radio is in Green Bay, half the staff is in Chicago. So, you know, there's a little bit of animosity there sometimes, depending on which team one is rooting for. And a recent national game that was broadcast between these two teams, Brett Favre, of course, the Hall of Fame quarterback for the Packers, was talking with Bill Swirsky's superfans outside of Chicago's Soldier Field before the game. You remember the superfans, right? Ditka, Polish Yashij, De Bears. Oh, we did. Yeah, there it is. The Bears. Come on, Lucas. Quit listening to Beethoven. Remember, you're...
Sorry, Kale. I was just getting really into Beethoven there. I forgot. I know. Producing your show.
Don't multitask. You got to produce the show, man. Come on. Anyways, Brett Favre always used to say, you know, you Chicago Bears fans, man, you've gotten a lot of mileage out of that one season. You know, I mean, it was one great year. It was a great year. Don't get me wrong, but the Packers have had a lot of good years since then. Anyhow. That the Super Bowl shuffle was not exactly up to Beethoven's standards. But Beethoven, as I mentioned, he was baptized the very next day after he was born. And as a Catholic, his faith actually informed a lot of his life and his music. And I think this is really fascinating. And he's really a great figure, you know, in when it comes to 2020, because 2020 has been a year of a lot of suffering mixed with the joys of everyday life, of course. And in Catholic New York, Garen Santacola wrote a nice piece about the 250th anniversary of Beethoven's birth. And he talked about Beethoven's late string quartets. And I know Lucas is an expert on this, but just, I know you know this, Lucas, but just for everyone else's sake, I want to explain this, that when he created his string quartet pieces, it actually, and this is really the pop music of his day, let's face it. You know, Lucas has forwarded that into the 21st century. You know, his pop idol is Beethoven. But when Beethoven first introduced these string quartets, they actually shocked the musicians who tried to play them and the audiences who listened to them. And he was actually criticized quite a bit. And Beethoven kind of, you know, he said, listen, it's not really music for now. It's music for the future. It's music for a later age. And a lot of this music, people thought it was a little bit strange, but it was actually fueled by a lot of Beethoven's personal angst, his deep struggles. And one of the things that was found in Beethoven's archives, on one of his drafts of sheet music for these pieces, he had actually written in the margins, "Let your deafness be no more a secret, even in your art." Yeah, you might know that Beethoven actually lost his hearing. He was only 27 years old when he began to lose his hearing, and that was obviously a devastating blow for someone like him in his profession. He had trained from childhood to be able to compete on the world stage with people like Mozart, people like Haydn, and he tried to hide his deafness for a long time because he was afraid if he admitted that he was going deaf that, you know, his career would be tanked. So for a long time, for many years, he lived in the hope of somehow finding a cure, but he eventually gave up on that, and he fell into a bit of a despair, a bit of a depression, and the only way that he could seem to get any relief was through his music. And one of his biographers, Jan Swofford, talked about Beethoven's evolution into being a composer who actually was able to use his suffering to fuel his art. He didn't give up on life. He actually used his suffering to make himself better and make his music better. And if you caught yesterday's program, you heard the tragic story. It's really just a very, very sad tale about Tony Shea, the American entrepreneur who unfortunately perished in a house fire, but his life was in a downward spiral. This happened over the Thanksgiving weekend. And where Tony Shea didn't have a faith to lean on, really, Beethoven did. And Jan Swofford, in his biography of Beethoven called Anguish and Triumph, talked about how his sufferings actually helped him go deeper into his music. And his own mother used to tell him all the time when he was growing up, without suffering, there is no struggle. Without struggle, there is no victory. And without victory, there is no crown. So Beethoven's mother obviously sounded like a very, very, you know, deep person spiritually who had a great interior life to be able to say something like that. So when Beethoven composed what was called the D major piano sonata of Opus 10. It was he actually wrote this right after he recovered from typhus and right before he began to definitively lose his hearing. And in this work, joy and suffering blend into a single theme, as Garen Santacola writes about this. And even his personal relationships were kind of, suffering was kind of a theme, even in how he related to other people. When he was in his late 30s, his deafness was getting worse and worse. He had a lot of other health problems. He actually invited a friend of his to come over and play some music with him, and it was the Baroness Dorothea von Ertmann. And she was a very talented keyboardist and one of his favorite interpreters of his work. And the Baroness had just suffered a personal tragedy of her own. She had just lost a child. And when she arrived to see Beethoven, Ludwig just sat at his piano and said, "We're going to talk, but we're actually going to talk not with words, but through music." And the two of them together improvised for over an hour. And the Baroness later said, quote, "He said everything to me through music and finally gave me consolation." So you can imagine what a heartrending scene that might have been, Beethoven making music for a bereaved woman who understood his work as well as anybody else alive, gave voice to her grief, and gave her hope. And that's really what his music is all about. It captures life in sorrow, in joy, and it's so appropriate for this year in 2020. And it was supposed to be a year filled with all kinds of celebrations. You know, this is a quarter of a millennium, you know, since he was born. But obviously COVID-19 changed all that. And as the world has fallen silent during this time, it's kind of a fitting metaphor because Beethoven's own world fell silent with his deafness. And this world should have really come alive with his music for these celebrations. And in the piece I was reading, it talked about another sort of segment on BBC, on the British Broadcasting Company, that was done on Beethoven. And this talked about how Beethoven wrote something called the Holy Song of Thanksgiving. The Holy Song of Thanksgiving. And he related, this BBC piece related that work to the health crisis that everybody's going through this year. And the Holy Song of Thanksgiving, Beethoven originally composed it as a song of thanks to God, you know, from somebody who's recovering from an illness. And he actually wrote it again, he had many, many sicknesses in his life. Just after he had recovered from a severe intestinal disorder that he thought he was going to actually die from, he wrote this piece. And it captures this range of emotions that's experienced by somebody who comes through an ordeal and is just grateful simply to be alive. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece. And this is exactly what's going on. And there's a lady who wrote a poem that sort of created some words for this piece of music, for the Song of Thanksgiving, the Holy Song of Thanksgiving. And here are the words I'm trying to find her name here. Her name is Miss Patel. And here are the words that she wrote for this piece, quote, "Raw edges of a wound coming together. God will find the pattern if you don't." Those are beautiful words. God will find the pattern if you don't. "A holy city, a halo of gold leaf, saying tomorrow is a mystery. Today is a gift from God. Without the dark, we would never see the stars." So this Holy Song of Thanksgiving from Beethoven is really the pinnacle of his journey of channeling his own personal suffering into artistic achievement and glory. And it really was for a later age. And he said, some of this stuff is for a later age. People aren't going to understand it now. And really, it's perfect for this year because it speaks to our time and the mystery that we're all going through, that suffering and joy is always going to be intertwined, especially here in 2020. So happy birthday, Beethoven. And I'm not sure you appreciated my birthday song for you, but we tried our best. Hey, you know what else was in the news? Speaking of COVID, you probably caught this. Tom Cruise, and we talk about Tom Cruise a lot on the show, Maverick himself, unleashed an absolutely epic rant. And you probably caught this. And if you didn't, I did tweet this out on my Twitter account, @KaleClark. You can check it out. Be forewarned, though, the full clip contains a lot of coarse language. Now, it's all bleeped out, but it's not exactly family-friendly listening. But what happened here was that some staffers, some crew members who were helping him film the latest installment of the Mission Impossible series, Mission Impossible 7, which right now is being filmed in London, the crew was not following COVID protocols. They weren't social distancing. They weren't wearing masks. And this actually put the whole production at risk. So they weren't following COVID protocols. But I am happy to inform you that they were indeed, there is some good news here, they were following Mission Impossible ghost protocols. And that might be funny only to me. Get it? There was a movie called, I can hear the crickets. Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol came out in 2011. Anyways, hey, if I'm not having a good time with the show, chances are you probably aren't either. So I thought that was funny, but you may disagree. Anyhow, Tom Cruise just absolutely let loose on his crew for putting the whole project in jeopardy. Let's listen to a bit of a clip of his rant here.
"I don't ever want to see it again. Ever. And if you don't do it, you're fired. That's it. No apologies. You can tell it to the people that are losing their homes because our industry is shut down. It's not going to put food on their table or pay for their college education. That's what I sleep with every night. So I'm sorry, I'm beyond your apologies. I have told you, and now I want it. And if you don't do it, you're out. Am I clear? Do you understand what I want? Do you understand the responsibility that you have?"
Okay, I had to laugh there when he said, "Are we clear? Are we clear?" And I was half expecting somebody to say, "Crystal." And that, of course, if you don't know, is a reference to maybe my favorite movie that Tom Cruise was ever in, A Few Good Men. Here's a clip from the scene, the courtroom scene between Lieutenant Junior Grade Daniel Caffey, who is interrogating the witness, Colonel Nathan Jessup, played by Jack Nicholson. Not Jack Nicholas, as my wife often likes to say. No, he's a professional golfer, was. Jack Nicholson, who sits at the floor on Laker games a lot of the time. Anyways, let's listen to the clip.
"A moment ago, you said that you ordered Lieutenant Kendrick to tell his men that Santiago wasn't to be touched."
"That's right."
"And Lieutenant Kendrick was clear on what you wanted?"
"Crystal."
"Any chance Lieutenant Kendrick ignored the order?"
"Ignored the order?"
"Any chance he forgot about it?"
"No."
Any chance Lieutenant Kendrick left your office and said, the old man is wrong?
No.
When Lieutenant Kendrick spoke to the platoon and ordered them not to touch Santiago, any chance they ignored him?
You ever served in an infantry unit, son?
No, sir.
Ever served in a forward area?
No, sir.
Ever put your life in another man's hands? Asked him to put his life in yours?
No, sir.
We follow orders, son. We follow orders or people die. It's that simple. Are we clear?
Yes, sir.
Are we clear?
Crystal.
All right. What a great clip from a fantastic movie. What a quotable movie. And in fact, a Twitter user, Matt, who's listening to the show in Massachusetts, Mattman34 is his Twitter handle, said, this is probably the most quotable movie ever. I could quote you this movie verbatim. And I'm right there with you, Matt. I have practically memorized this film. So many great scenes, so many great lines. We follow orders or people die. Well, really, the tables have been turned here because now Tom Cruise is saying this to his employees, really, the crew of Mission Impossible 7. And really, I kind of don't blame him for this. I really don't like it when bosses, you know, abuse their power and scream at their employees and get angry and kind of just let loose on them. But in this case, I think maybe it's actually justified here because there are a lot of people's jobs here on the line. And I don't know if you know this, but Tom Cruise actually has already paid $500,000. He paid $500,000 out of his own money to rent a cruise ship, no pun intended, a cruise ship to keep the crew of Mission Impossible 7 safely isolated during this global pandemic. I mean, they've been filming this all over the world, Rome, and now they're in London. So he's on edge because Hollywood is watching this to see if it's possible for a big budget film to be pulled off in this time of COVID-19. So it's an experiment. It's an experiment. It's not just a movie. It's an experiment. And as you know, a lot of production in Hollywood has shut down. And so many people, I know there's a lot of people listening to the show right now in LA, so many people who live in that region, who live in California, have been impacted, who their livelihoods derive from the film industry. So a lot is really riding on this. And you can see this is why Cruise is so upset. And as a general rule, as Vinay Menon said in the Toronto Star today, you know, whenever you hear somebody talking and their voice gets louder and louder and louder until the very last thing they say is the loudest word of all, that's when you know they're really, really mad. And that's exactly what happened to Cruise here. And you know what? I kind of don't blame him for this. He's not being a prima donna. He's not on a power trip here. He's trying to keep this production going. And, you know, I can identify with this because, as you know, I had a, you know, somewhat truncated movie career, shall we say. You might remember this when I first came on Relevant Radio. I did tell you the story about how I was an extra, a lowly extra on the movie Titanic. And yeah. Oh, it's bringing me back. It's bringing me back, these tunes. And, you know, it was tough. It was tough. I was on a ship in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and it was cold. And, you know, I was wearing my Canadian tuxedo, my lumberjack outfit, you know, my plaid, you know, jacket, and just shivering. And the director, James Cameron, wouldn't talk to me. And we're eating bad catered food. And, you know, Kate Winslet isn't speaking to me. Leo DiCaprio won't give me the time of day. I don't know. Maybe they will now that I have a radio show. Maybe they'll come on. Maybe I'm important now. I don't know. Anyways, you know, I got paid a little bit. I still have my pay stub from the Titanic movie. So I can prove it. This isn't a made-up story. It's real. And all I know is that a lot of people, lowly Russian sailor extras, are depending on, you know, Tom Cruise to get this done so that their lives can go on, so that they can be employed. Absolutely. You know, put their kids through college, put food on the table. So, you know what? I'm going to give Tom Cruise a pass here. I'm going to give him a pass. And Bill Cronin, who listens to the show regularly, tweeted at me, you know what? You know, this guy is going to have to account for his apostate Scientology at his exit interview. And that's true. That's true. You know, all of us have an exit interview coming up, and it's not over yet, Bill. It's not over yet. You know, Tom's only 58. He's a young 58. He's got a lot of road ahead of him, hopefully. And we need to pray that he'll come back to his Catholic faith, to the Catholic faith of his youth. And wouldn't it be great if Tom Cruise did re-embrace the Catholic faith, if he jettisoned Scientology as he should, come back to the faith. That's why we tried to get a hashtag going earlier in the year, hashtag make Cruz Catholic again. It did not trend. It did not trend. We tried. Three people retweeted it, my mother and a couple other folks. And anyways, but we need to really keep praying for this guy, because he has an eternal soul as well, and he could influence a lot of people if he came back to the faith. But, you know, I don't put too much stock in celebrity conversions or reversions anyways. Heck, even within the church, you know, we've got enough problems with officials in the church who aren't practicing the faith. So we got to put our hope in Christ for sure, but keep praying for him and pray that he will come back to the church. So get that hashtag going, Catholic Twitter. Where are you? Hashtag make Cruz Catholic again. And we will be back again right after this break on the Cale Clark Show.
The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Some epic music there to bring you back to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Give us a call, 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call, 1-888-914-9149. And speaking of epic, this is the epic year of St. Joseph, which just was proclaimed a couple of days ago, and we want to help you fully experience this year. So Relevant Radio is offering you all kinds of different resources. They're going to help you grow in your devotion to the adoptive father of our Savior and the most chaste spouse of the Blessed Mother. All you've got to do is go to relevantradio.com or use the Relevant Radio app and just click on the banner to experience the year of St. Joseph. That's what the banner is going to say, experience the year of St. Joseph. Just click on it. Nothing could be easier. And you'll be able to register for us to send you a free booklet for the year of St. Joseph. And that's going to include a few things. First, it's going to include the seven sorrows and seven joys of St. Joseph and the Holy Father's prayer to St. Joseph for this year dedicated to him and much, much more. And you're also going to receive a monthly spiritual reflection on St. Joseph from Father Rocky himself and other Relevant Radio hosts, including yours truly, all throughout the year. So there's going to be 19 reflections. And that makes sense because St. Joseph's feast day is, of course, on March the 19th. So that's going to be great. Also, when you register, that's not all. We're going to give you a lot of other, you know, little treats throughout the year. And I'm going to save those as surprises for now, but you are guaranteed not to miss any of them if you go to the Relevant Radio app or to relevantradio.com and just click on the banner, experience the year of St. Joseph. So go to relevantradio.com right now. Actually, don't do it now. Wait till the show is over because we want to have your full attention, of course. And hey, I'm going to bring up Patrick Alog right now because he's a big Hoops fan. Patrick, what did you think of the big Supermax contract that was signed by Milwaukee's Giannis Antetokounmpo? I knew I was going to mess that up. I can't even say this. I'm going to try that again. Yeah, that was it. I just call him the Greek freak just to make it easier so I don't have to trip over my words.
Maybe Giannis could give some of his $228 million contract to Relevant Radio. That would help.
That would actually be good. We should start a campaign. You know, let's get a Twitter handle going for that one, Twitter hashtag. But, you know, I was encouraged by this. You know, I'm a little bit sad because one of my own personal prayers is going to go unanswered. And I wasn't really praying for this, but I was kind of hoping that Giannis would sign with, of course, the Toronto Raptors. And one of the reasons why I was hoping for this was because the president of the Raptors, Masai Ujiri, is actually from Nigeria. And even though Giannis is called the Greek freak, he's actually from Nigeria. He did spend a lot of time growing up, of course, in Greece. But, you know, the connection between Ujiri, who's done so much for basketball on that continent, and Giannis, I thought maybe he could talk him into it. But it was not to be.
You know what? As a Lakers fan, you know, people were thinking, oh, maybe he'll join with the Lakers or something like that. But I like the loyalty. I do too. I don't know if that's the reason why you wanted to bring it up, but I like the loyalty about, you know what? I'm going to stay here in the city I grew up in, growing up after I was drafted in the city of Milwaukee, which some might say is a quote-unquote small market team. But I just like like the loyalty of just, you know, staying in the market and trying to build your, you know, build a championship team there, and is raising a family as well as a his father became gave birth earlier this year. But yeah, so it's nice to see the loyalty with Giannis.
I think so too, and it's good for the league in general too. It's good for these small market teams. It makes the league a lot more interesting, you know, if there aren't, you know, super teams in three or four key cities and that's it, and everybody else is kind of an also-ran. This is great for competitive balance, and I think it's good for Milwaukee. It's good for Wisconsin. He'll be, you know, geographically close to relevant radio. Perhaps we can pull him in for a donation or two. I don't know. Anyways, just go to relevantradio.com, Giannis, if you're listening, and make your donation now. But no, he's come a long way. At one point, he was actually selling trinkets on the streets in Athens, Greece. He had to share a pair of shoes with his brother. I don't think he's been blessed with a lot of resources now, and those tough times are now over for him. So congratulations to Giannis. Great, great player. And hey, support Relevant Radio, Giannis. Anyways, speaking of sports, my daughter, Michaela, she knows I'm a big sports fan, and she did catch me off guard with a golf joke. I'm a big golf fan today, and here's what she said to me at lunchtime.
Why does a golfer carry two pairs of socks when he goes to golf? Because he might get a hole in one.
He might get a hole in one. Well, it's never happened to me, but maybe one day. Anyways, Michaela's been working on her comedy routine. She's got a lot of kid jokes saved up, and she wants to do a segment here on Relevant Radio Live one day. So I don't know. I mean, I'm a little bit hesitant to turn over the mic to her, and I might never get it back. But anyways, I thought that was pretty cool. And you know what else is cool too? That's a really good joke. It is a really good joke, Patrick. Yeah. What's really cool today as well was listening to the scripture reading for Mass today for this Wednesday of the third week of Advent, the gospel reading from Luke chapter 7. It's a very, very interesting one. And here's what it says in Luke 7, and this starts at verse 18. It says, at that time, John, and this is, of course, John the Baptist, who's a key figure in the Advent readings, John summoned two of his disciples and sent them to the Lord to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? And by the way, at this time, John is in prison. He is languishing in Herod's fortress prison called Machaerus. It's like Alcatraz. You're not getting out of this thing. He's in a rough, rough spot. And of course, we know that eventually he's going to die. So he's asking his followers, some of his disciples, to go to Jesus. Are you the one who is to come? They're supposed to ask Jesus. Now, that's a nice way of saying, are you the Messiah? And every Jew would have understood what they were saying. Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? When the men came to the Lord, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? At that time, Jesus cured many of their diseases, sufferings, and evil spirits. He also granted sight to many who were blind. And Jesus said to them in reply, go and tell John what you have seen and what you have heard. The blind regain their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the good news proclaimed to them, and blessed is the one who takes no offense at me. Now, that's an interesting response by Jesus, because he doesn't come out and say, of course I'm the Messiah, you know, and he could have said that, but there are a lot of reasons why he wouldn't have wanted to do that. Number one, politically, it's pretty dangerous. If he said, yeah, I'm the Messiah, word's going to get back to the Romans. There's a lot of political tension. There's a lot of, sort of sentiment among the people that we need to overthrow the Romans. We need to kick them out of the Holy Land. And in fact, there were many would-be messiahs in Jesus's day, political messiahs, who tried to do exactly that, and they were crushed. But Jesus hasn't completed his ministry yet, so he will admit it. He will say it when the time is right, as he did during his trial before the high priest. He said, yes, I am the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One, and you will see me coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest freaks out, tears his garments, blasphemy, condemns him to death. But why is it that John was doubting? Why is it that he was wondering whether Jesus really was the Messiah or not? Shouldn't John know this? I mean, he's a relative of the Lord. He pointed the way towards Jesus. And, you know, what is going on here? Well, there is a reason why John was having his doubts as he was languishing in prison. And the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls shed a lot of light on this passage. Now, again, the Dead Sea Scrolls, and if you've been to Israel, you've probably been to the Dead Sea region, the lowest point on planet Earth, the caves around the Dead Sea at a place called Qumran. These Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered in 1947 were absolutely key. That, by the way, these are not Christian documents. These are not Christian documents. These are documents written by Jews, and they date to about the 3rd century before Christ to the 1st century A.D. Carbon 14 dating has revealed this. And they were discovered in 1947 when a young shepherd boy, a young Bedouin shepherd boy, and it's amazing, people there live essentially the same as they did 2,000 years ago out in the wilderness, these Bedouin shepherds, and he was literally looking for his lost sheep. What a biblical image that is. And he had thought that perhaps his sheep had gotten loose and wandered up into one of these caves in the mountains. So he picks up a stone, throws it into the mouth of one of the caves, and he was expecting to maybe startle the sheep will come out. But he doesn't hear a thud. You know, when he throws the rock in, he hears a crash. Pshh! He hears something shatter. He says, "What's that?" So, you know, he climbs up, being young and limber, he climbs up, goes into the cave, and he finds these jars of pottery, and they've been smashed open. And inside the jars are these scrolls. Some of them were leather, some of them were parchment. And he thought, "These are strange. I don't understand the writing on these scrolls, but I'm going to take them to my dad and see what he says." So he brings them home, and his dad says, he takes a look at the leather scrolls, and he says, "Oh, these would make a fine pair of sandals. But wait a minute, I better get this checked out by somebody who knows what they're doing, who knows what the writing on these scrolls might mean, in case there's something valuable." And it's a good thing he did, because this was the greatest archaeological find of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And one of the scrolls that they found really, again, these aren't Christian documents, but what they do is they shed light on what people believed, or at least what this one group of Jews that lived in these caves in this desert region, what they were expecting the Messiah to do and to be. And in fact, they thought there were going to be two Messiahs. And these are the Essenes, probably, the group of Jews known as the Essenes who lived in this desert region, wrote the scrolls in some of their own documents. Now, of course, they had, you know, copies of the Old Testament books there as well, including the great Isaiah scroll, helped verify that the Old Testament is legitimate. It hasn't been corrupted over the years. But they had a lot of their own documents as well. And one of these documents says that there's going to be two Messiahs. There's going to be a priestly Messiah and a kingly Messiah. And there was going to be a great battle at the end of time in which the kingly Messiah was going to slay the Roman emperor, who they called the King of the Kittim, or the King of the Gentiles. And these guys were really hardcore, by the way, in the way they practiced their Jewish faith. They thought the Pharisees were liberals. They thought the Pharisees were too wishy-washy in their faith. A lot of people want to say that John the Baptist was actually belonging to this community at Qumran. In fact, when you go there, they show you a little movie when you're on the site, and they kind of say, maybe John was one of these guys. Well, we have no evidence for that. It's an interesting theory, but even if he was, by the time, you know, the events of the New Testament happened, he's not with them anymore. He's on his own. But I highly doubt it. Well, there's a lot of interesting things that have been found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But here's the question I want to answer today, and it has to do with today's reading. Did Jesus, in fact, claim to be the Messiah? Because there are a lot of scholars, especially in the 20th century, who tried, it was very trendy for them to say that Jesus never thought he was the Messiah. This is something that the church made up later. They invented this. Jesus had no designs on being the Messiah. Now, it's true that he never went out in the public square and said, "Hey, everybody, I'm the Messiah." But there's a reason for that. Like I said, if you had eyes to see and ears to hear, his teachings indeed spoke pretty loudly. Like, this is exactly why Jesus does what he does in today's gospel. When these followers of John the Baptist say, "Are you the one who is to come? Or should we look for somebody else?" Well, Jesus kind of does a show-and-tell thing here. He cures many people of their diseases, their sufferings, and their evil spirits. He's casting out demons, gives sight to the blind. He's doing all this stupendous, you know, stuff. And then he says to them, "Go and tell John what you've seen and heard here. You know, blessed is the one who takes no offense at me." My actions should speak pretty loudly here. And one of the scrolls actually sheds a lot of light on this passage. And this is one of the documents that came from Cave 4. This was the big one. This was where the mother load of all the scrolls were found, Cave number 4. And it's document number 521 from cave fort, Qumran. It's known as 4Q521. And here's what it says. This is amazing. It says, "For the heavens and the earth will listen to his Messiah. He will honor the devout upon the throne of eternal royalty. He will free the prisoners, give sight to the blind, straighten out the twisted or the lame, and the Lord will perform marvelous acts. He will heal the badly wounded. He will make the dead live. He will proclaim good news to the meek, give lavishly to the needy, lead the exiles, and enrich the hungry." That's an incredible quote. And Jesus is doing these things. When they come to Jesus, "Hey, are you the Messiah?" "Oh, just watch what I'm going to do." He gives sight to the blind. He heals the lame. He's doing all this stuff. He raises the dead. Jesus does all this in his ministry. But why is John doubting? Well, where's John? He's in prison. He's stuck in Machaerus in the fortress prison of Herod. One of the things that the Messiah was supposed to do, according to the Dead Sea Scrolls, was free the prisoners. So John is basically saying, if you're really the Messiah, why am I still here? Do a prison break already. Get me out of this place. The food's terrible. And Jesus is basically saying, yeah, I'm the Messiah. My deeds show it. If you're perceptive, you'll see it. What he's basically saying is, yeah, I am the Messiah in a very culturally relevant way that would have been understood by everybody, because this is what people were expecting the Messiah to do. Now, in terms of the prison break, you're just going to have to trust me on that. And unfortunately, John was called to martyrdom. He had to pay with his life for standing up for the truth. But he's in heaven now, so everything is fine. And that's a really good background for this passage. Jesus is basically saying, I'm the Messiah. I'm going to show this in a very culturally relevant way. Maybe the Romans won't figure it out, but you'll know. And yes, I am, is basically what he says there. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Got to take a quick break right now. We'll be right back. 1-888-914-9149.
The U.S. Catholic bishops have stated, "The threat of abortion remains our preeminent priority because it directly attacks life itself.
Because it takes place within the sanctuary of the family.
Because of the number of lives it destroys.
Let's continue to ask Our Lady's intercession.
And pray for an end to abortion in our country.
And the protection of human life from the moment of conception to natural death."
Hi, this is Bishop Thomas Olmsted of the Diocese of Phoenix. Let us pray. Remember, O Most Gracious Virgin Mary, that never was it known that anyone who fled to thy protection, implored thy help, or sought thy intercession, was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, I fly unto thee, O Virgin of Virgins, my Mother. To thee do I come. Before thee I stand, sinful and sorrowful. O Mother of the Word Incarnate, despise not my petitions, but in thy mercy hear and answer me. Amen.
Underwriting by the University of Mary.
As a working mother, I was thrilled to learn about the University of Mary's new online Catholic-infused graduate programs that truly work around my schedule.
University of Mary knows that choosing to continue your education at this point in life can be both challenging and rewarding. That's why we've created a robust portfolio of truly affordable, truly flexible, and truly formative online programs to make choosing easy. Visit us at catholicprofessional.life. That's .life.
Relevant Radio is supported by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union. You already share their Catholic values. Why not share in their benefits? Complete a virtual financial checkup and they'll donate $150 in your name to an eligible parish, school, or nonprofit, including Relevant Radio. Full offer details at notredamefcu.com/elevate. Insured by NCUA.
Do you or someone you know struggle with same-sex attraction? This is Timory from Trending with Timory. Wednesday marriage and family therapist Michael Gasparo joins me to discuss conversion therapy. What is it and what is it not? I'll discuss what we should understand as people of faith when it comes to freedom, chastity, counseling, gender, and same-sex attraction. Join me daily at 6 p.m. Central on Relevant Radio or the Relevant Radio app.
The Relevant Radio studio line is sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters. Information about employment opportunities and their flexible premium life insurance plans is available at relevantradio.com/forester.
so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back. Call in 1-888-914-9149. It's the studio line for the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And I got to apologize to everybody here because yesterday we were asking you what your favorite Christmas movie was. And unfortunately, a lot of you were not able to get through on the phone lines. And that's because we, along with most other radio networks across the United States, use a special software. And unfortunately, this software was pretty much down all across the country for a period of time yesterday. So that's why a lot of you couldn't get through. I want to apologize for that. It's kind of like when Google went down, you know, on Monday and Tuesday, Google went down for a little while. And a lot of people started to realize how much of their life depended on Google. And if you tried to Google why Google was down, well, obviously it didn't work. Anyways, I did read about one guy on Twitter who said, "I'm sitting here in the dark in my toddler's room. Our home is controlled by Google Home, and I'm starting to rethink a lot of things right now." Anyhow, talk about a fatal error. Well, Christmas movies, we tried to get you to call in about that. And one of the favorite Christmas movies of a lot of people is Charlie Brown's Christmas. And back when Charlie Brown, you know, back in the 1960s, I think this was made in 1965, and I recently showed it to my wife and my daughter because it's on Apple Plus now. They've got the rights to it. We were watching a Charlie Brown Christmas, and Charlie Brown, of course, is just so upset about the commercialization of Christmas. And a lot of people are asking the question, you know, "I need some help here. I don't know how to help my kids focus on Christ during Advent and during the Christmas season." So maybe you can relate. And I don't know. I love a Charlie Brown Christmas. I love the music, the soundtrack. Think about the great piano tunes from Schrader. You know, he knew a lot of Beethoven, that's for sure. And it's just great stuff. I love it. I love it so much. And Charlie Brown, of course, was lamenting the absence of anybody out there who could help him find the true meaning of Christmas. And you know what? I read a great article by William P. Smith about this when he talks about how our world frames the Christmas season as really just a big month-long midwinter party, flooding us with images of happy gatherings, you know, which we don't really have much of this year, tables loaded up with food, lots of gifts, soft lights, beautiful trees, amazing music. And our kids get barraged with these same sorts of images too. And these images come with a promise. If you enter into this vision of Christmas, you will find joy and comfort. You'll feel warm and secure. And if you want to throw in a bit of a religious component, tack it on, that's okay too, but it's not really necessary. That's really how the world, you know, looks at Christmas. And that makes sense because there's always a war against God on every front in the culture. And of course, the enemy would like nothing more than to turn our, you know, contemplation of our Savior's birth into an event that really pushes him out to the periphery. So how can we get our families to recapture the true meaning of Christmas without, you know, allowing ourselves to be influenced too much by the values of secular culture when it comes to the holiday season? By the way, the word holiday actually means holy day. That's where it comes from. So we can't get away from the religious meaning of Christmas by saying happy holidays. You're basically saying happy holy days. It's there. Whether you like it or not, Christmas is about Christ. So how can we find Christ in the season? How can we make Jesus the true reason for the season and help our families focus on him too? Well, there's a few things that we're going to want to do, according to William Smith. First of all, it's a really good thing to try to make some time with your family for conversations that can build a Christian worldview for your kids. I think it's a great idea to, you know, maybe during family dinners, take some time and just read a little bit of the Christmas account, the infancy narratives of Christ in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Just pick one of them and maybe read a chapter a day. You know, at the family dinner table, and maybe just talk about it a little bit for 5 minutes. If you have some sort of a book of Christmas devotionals, you can maybe share them really, really quickly. And this helps kids to be reminded that, you know, there's a Godward dimension of life, as Smith puts it. We've got to expand their world a little bit so that, you know, they can think of the vertical plane, not just the horizontal plane, what's going on, you know, in this world with their friends, everything that's happening in the media. As C.S. Lewis said, we've got to trace the sunbeam back up to the sun. We've got to trace the sunbeam back up to the sun. What does he mean by that? We've got to learn how to find God in everything in life. So if you're out with your family, you're looking at the Christmas lights, or you're decorating your own tree, you could tell your child, you know, think about how these lights remind us of the light of the world, Jesus Christ. We're celebrating his coming. The hope that we have, but yet we really don't deserve, but God's given it to us. We were once the people walking in darkness, but now we see a great light. Great light has come. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 2. So that's a great way to do it. You know, you can look at mundane earthly images and try to supernaturalize them. Think about presents. You know, how your child thinks about gifts, giving and receiving gifts is really key. We've got to teach them that principle that it really is better to give than to receive. That's what St. Paul says in the Acts of the Apostles. He said that our Lord taught this. It's not mentioned anywhere in the Gospels, but Paul teaches this. So Jesus obviously did say this at some time. It is more blessed to give than to receive, Acts chapter 20, verse 35. So when your child gives to another, they're going to get a lot of joy out of this. And children love to give presents to others too. They don't just love to get presents. They love to give. And it's especially rewarding to give to those who can't give anything back to us. And when we give generously, when we give, you know, really till it hurts, we're going to have to give up something that maybe we would want in order to give something to someone else. So a kid might take some of their allowance and do something for somebody who can't afford it, buy a toy for a child who can't afford it. There are, of course, a lot of toy drives going on during the Christmas season. So really, this is all deriving from the fact that God gave us the greatest gift in the Christmas season. He gave us himself. So that's what we have to do, first of all. We've got to really supernaturalize the season and help our kids to see the world, and especially this season, through Catholic glasses, a Catholic worldview. The second thing we've got to do is we've got to expose the foolishness of the world when it comes to this. We've got to teach our kids to think critically about the kind of messages that they're being bombarded with all the time through advertising. And these are received passively as we're watching television, watching the net. A lot of kids, you know, we all get these messages, not just kids, but adults too, that, you know, life will be perfect if we only have this one new gadget. Has that ever actually happened in your life? You know, have you ever gotten something and been eternally happy because of it? No, you might have been, you know, reasonably satisfied for a little while, but it doesn't bring lasting joy. I remember when John Scott, a former NHL hockey player, was on the program. You know, he said, you know, people are envious of professional athletes because they make so much money. We talked about Giannis earlier with his big contract. A lot of these guys are miserable. A lot of these guys are absolutely miserable because these things don't have the power to give us what we really need inside. They can't make us good people. They can't give us a good life. So we've got to resist the temptation to rely on these externals. We've got to help our children also, and this is key too, get ready for the fact that all of us go through a bit of a letdown after Christmas, after December the 25th. There's a bit of a tiredness. You know, we're exhausted from the holidays. We need a vacation from our vacation in a lot of ways. There's often a bit of an emptiness that can carry on into the, you know, the sort of doldrums of January and February. Think about that in advance. That's what William Smith says. Think about this in advance and understand that you might be a bit gloomy after Christmas. And the reason why a lot of people feel that way, they feel let down after Christmas, is because they put too much hope in the material world. They put too much hope in things. You can't take these good things that God's given us to enjoy and expect it to fill your soul. Only Christ can do that. The creation can never replace the Creator. And this is the trap that human beings have always fallen into from the very beginning. And St. Paul talks about this in his letter to the Romans, chapter 1. You can't let the creation replace the Creator. So try to unpack that with your family. Focus your kids on Christ. Try to get them to see him in the manger as the center of their world. In as many ways you can do that as possible. But don't forget, if you want it to be true for them, it also has to be true for you. Because if it's not, they're going to pick up on it. You have to focus on Christ. You have to be enthralled by him, enraptured by him far more than you are by anything that's out there in the world this Advent and this Christmas. Thanks for joining me on the Cale Clark Show today. It's been a lot of fun. I really want to thank producer Lucas Holt for spinning all his Beethoven tunes today and doing such great work on the board. I want to thank Patrick Alog for screening the calls, Karen Moran for working social media. We'll be back tomorrow. Can't wait to see you then. Timory's up next. Stay tuned. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.